My name is Charlotte Burney, and I'm a 17-year-old attending the Ethical Culture Fieldston School in New York City. My goal is to explore the nationwide anxiety epidemic by hearing from authors, specialists, and educators. This is A is for Anxiety.
Today, I am lucky to speak with nutritionist Lauren Slayton. Lauren Slayton is the founder of Food Trainers and the author of the book, The Little Book of Thin. She received her undergraduate degree from Tulane University, where she graduated cum laude with honors in sociology. It was here that she first realized the challenge of balancing work and play, healthy and indulgent. She completed her master's degree in clinical nutrition at New York University. Prior to opening Food Trainers, Lauren worked at St. Luke's Roosevelt Obesity Research Unit and developed a nutrition program for the Equinox Fitness Club. These positions provided Lauren both clinical and counseling experience in the fall, and in the fall of 2001, Lauren opened Food Trainers. The New York Times, The Today Show, Allure, In Style, Harper's Bazaar, O Magazine, The New York Post, The Daily Show, CBS News, Good Morning America, Cranes NY, and many others have been lucky to have Lauren as a partner. Lauren, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So my first question is a question that I like to ask most of the people that I interview, which is really why they got into what they're doing. So tell me a little bit about your journey to become a nutritionist. What encouraged you to want this as a profession?
So I'll give you the abridged reason or version, which I think might resonate with some of your listeners. So I was always just, you know, math and science-y. And in college, the natural step was to be pre-med. Everything seemed okay. My courses were great. It sort of felt firmly on that path until I was due to take the MCATs. And I'm a good test taker, so I wasn't necessarily apprehensive, you know, in terms of results. Mm-hmm. But the night before I was due to take the test, I had the first panic attack I've ever had in my life. I actually ended up taking the MCATs at yeshiva with everybody who is religious instead of taking it on the Saturday when I was supposed to take it. But I went ahead and I applied to med school. But as I started to hear from schools, I realized I never wanted to go. So I'm in my 40s. Nutrition was different then, but I looked at programs at NYU and Columbia and ended up in the master's program at NYU. And really from, you know, just in terms of following your gut, from my very first graduate school class, I was in love. So I think, you know, listen to your intuition, what it's telling you. The career that, you know, sounds good on paper isn't necessarily what ends up being the best match for you.
Exactly. And I think that's really interesting because for some, that anxiety is what will stop them from actually leaving the path that they had always thought that they were going to take. But sometimes making that decision is actually what leads to people being very happy.
Yeah. And it's really funny in terms of what you say, you know, the path you want to take. So it was years after I had been working, you know, as a mother with two kids and my book came out, in, I think, 2013, and I'm sitting in the car with my mother just to know that, you know, and she looks at me and she says, you know, I think it worked out. And I said, well, what do you mean? And she goes, I think this nutrition thing. And I was like, wait, this whole time for my entire career, you've been thinking it hasn't worked out. But I think, again, like, you know, the MD or doctor is like, especially for someone of my mother's generation, was much easier to grasp. Then, like, I still don't think she knows what I do on a daily basis, but that's okay.
Definitely. So off of what you were just saying, will you please tell the listeners what kind of work you do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, so I think before, like, all of this, in terms of quarantine, most of my day was spent in, you know, sort of my Upper West Side, New York City offices, one-on-one with clients. And I love this. I mean, I, as you said, did obesity research after grad school, and it was great, and I learned a lot. But my favorite part was always, at that time, the 5 minutes I had with the study participants.
Yeah.
But I also write, you know, both, you know, for our company and for others, and conduct lectures. And of course, I think just to be up on everything, read and research a lot.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. That sounds like really important work, and I think it's really great that you're able to really build those one-on-one connections with people through this process.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, I always say, like, I couldn't lecture and write if I didn't have, like, that pulse as to what people were feeling. And I think as much as, like, I love everyone's individual story, what you see and what I've seen, like, and I know we're going to get to this, but is that, like generally what's happening to each of us is not that unusual. You know, mm-hmm. we all sort of cope similarly. I even started our newsletter today with, like, a client saying to me, like, is this happening to anyone else? And I'm like, it's happening to everyone else right now.
Yes.
I think there's comfort in that in terms of our eating.
Completely. So getting right into it, could you please describe what are some of the long-term effects that a balanced diet has on the well-being of one's body and mind?
Yeah, and I hope I don't embarrass you, but I just wanted to pause and say that you had sent me before we started your questions, and your questions are fantastic. I do things like this all the time, and the questions are usually really silly. So thank you. So my favorite part, like, of what you just said is just this long-term effects of nutrition. I think that nutrition still has a little bit of a legacy of this, like, quick fix, maybe not this year, but pre-summer, pre-vacation, what am I going to do this week, that kind of thing. And I always tell my clients, like, when it comes to eating, it's not what you do once in a blue moon, but, like, what you're eating really like day in and day out. Mm-hmm. And if we look at, like, almost every major disease state, from diabetes to Alzheimer's, has a component of inflammation, which is basically, you know, sort of how our body is responding to our diet. So I think we need to start as early as possible. I think it's difficult when you're young to think about, you know, your 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. But it really, you know, what we're doing really is about our well-being for the long haul.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think, I mean, I definitely feel this of you. I eat really healthy for a week and I'm like, well, now all of my problems are solved.
Right, exactly. No, and it's not to say, you know, I think that's actually one of the nice things about nutrition is that you can eat well for a couple of days and feel remarkably different. So you do get that quick payoff in terms of, like, oh, like, I have clients who come back after a week and they're like, I'm sleeping better. My skin looks a little better. I'm not dragging as much. You know, I love that. Mm-hmm. But I also think we just need to do it for more than a week.
Yes, definitely. So on the flip side, when mm-hmm. I eat something really unhealthy, it tends mm-hmm. to feel good for a few minutes. You eat a really good brownie and you're like, wow, I loved that. That was delicious. Mm-hmm. But then my body feels terrible. And I feel like it's really horrible for my mental health when I eat a bunch of unhealthy food, because then I'm just mad at myself. Right. So could you describe what happens to our bodies and our mind when we eat too much that's unhealthy?
Yeah, and I think, you know, sort of the mind part of that question draws me in even more. So I think that exactly what you described, that 5 minutes of feeling good is very accurate. And then depending on the situation, the guilt or the shame can set in, which then ironically leads to, for the most part, most of us consuming subsequent unhealthy foods.
Yeah.
So I think something that's really helpful that we do with clients is something called treat training. So we, you know, I like the word and concept of treat more than cheat. So to avoid those feelings of, like, what did I do, or just the physical feelings of indigestion, planning out something. So, like, I am on Friday going to bake blah, 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 or celebrate a birthday, and I'm going to have whatever the treat is that you plan on having. It kind of makes it so that it's part of your plan versus, like, an oops.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The second part of that would be, like, portioning it. So again, like you said, you might feel lousy from a brownie, but we really feel lousy if we have six brownies. You know, that
exactly.
Kind of thing. So having it in, like, I'm having a piece of cake, but this is, like, a human-sized piece of cake. I think also different from, like, when we feel like we're, like, cheating on something, savoring it. So rather than speed eating something and then feeling, you know, like garbage, like, this is a delicious brownie. I love brownies. You know, I haven't had, you know, a sweet in a couple of days. And then I think you can move on guilt-free. you know, sort yeah, of go that right makes back sense. To normal. But that's a skill set. And I, you know, I agree with you. I think that, you know, sort of we eat things because in the short run, they do taste good. And I think it's important to enjoy the food that you eat. But I think that if it's like too much in the unhealthy category, we just don't feel good.
Yeah, definitely. And I think what you said before about sort of feeling guilty and that leading to just eating more is really interesting, because I would say I definitely find myself doing that. And I know that my friends do that as well.
Yeah, we sort of get the efforts, you know, for lack of a better word, that, you know, I ruined it. And that's why, you know, no one instance ruins anything. And what, you know, how you can sort of, I use the term victory, turn it into a victory is like, okay, I had an afternoon, I had, you know, too much of whatever the treat food is, I'm still going to have my normal healthy dinner. Like, just instead of, you know, yo-yoing between the guilt and then trying to be perfect and then trying and then feeling guilty, just going right back to normal is sort of the best way to feel good.
Yeah. And I know it's also really easy to find yourself like, oh, I ate a really bad breakfast, so therefore it's just going to be my bad day and I'm going to eat
everything. Right. The day is ruined, right?
Yeah. When that really isn't the case.
And I think that, you know, and we have all these games we play, like, you know, I'll wait till Monday, I'll wait till tomorrow, I'll wait. No. Like, you'll feel like, okay, you had, I know we're not supposed to use good and bad, but you had this, you know, sort of treaty breakfast, like, have a salad for lunch, you know, have go right back to normal. And I think it makes it so that we don't only have these two gears of like, you know, perfect and awful.
Yeah, that makes sense. So on the topic of treats, many say that sugar is actually addictive. So could you speak to this a little bit?
Absolutely. Well, the best example I always give is that, you know, in research studies, rats will choose, we're a lot like rodents, by the way, in terms of, that's why they're always used. But rats will choose a sugar solution like sugar water over cocaine. So wow. I think, you know, we all have in our heads that cocaine is addictive, but wouldn't necessarily rank sugar above it. So it's, you know, sort of definitely alluring in that regard. And part of how it works in our body is also that sweet begets sweet. So it's not just that we eat the brownie that you just mentioned, but that if there's, you know, sort of lots of sugar in our diet, the sugar is going to sound a lot better to someone like that than when it's not there.
Yeah. So do you think with time, it's an addiction that we can break? As you were saying, if you eat less sugar, you're going to crave it less.
Yeah, I think, well, I think twofold. I think people who love sweets, and I would say that's probably 75% of everyone, you will always, I always say to clients, you're always going to like those foods, you know, they taste good. But even by displacement, like sometimes the first step is that I, you know, sort of go about addressing is adding in the non-sweet foods even before we work on like the removal of the sugar. So adding things that are, you know, savory or salty or bitter sometimes helps with that drive for the sweet.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And I think the thing is that we all feel sort of like, you know, almost like it's hopeless. Like I can't stop eating this. I, you know, sort of always overdo it on this. This is all I want. And the truth is, it is gradual. Like when somebody comes in and they have a very processed diet or a very sweet diet, you know, the notion of broccoli, like it doesn't even sound good to them, you know, so you have to just gradually work on, you know, one thing I do when clients have major, you know, sweet tooths or sweet teeth is to, I call it like once, you know, sweet sensation, which is trying to pick the one time in the day, if you can, I'm not talking about fruit or anything like that, but do you really want something sweet in the afternoon? Do you like die if you can't have, you know, some chocolate after dinner? Trying to isolate it in that way gives people the sense that they can have it, but that their whole day isn't sweet.
Exactly. So in a time of stress, like quarantine, for example, many people turn to food as a coping mechanism. Mm-hmm. So how do we find the balance between using food to help ourselves cope and remaining physically healthy? And sort of the second fold to that question that I'm now thinking of is, I think baking is an activity that is definitely picked up through quarantine. Like, I personally find baking really relaxing, but if I make a delicious banana bread, there's no chance I'm not going to eat it. Right. So how do we how do we find that balance?
So I completely agree. Even in the beginning of quarantine, I almost didn't want to, like, work with clients because I felt, you know, in my heart, like there's so many other things to talk about. Like, is it really important? And my mind went back to sort of a lesson that I learned with a client when I was first practicing. This man had, it just illustrates this the best for me. This man had a sick parent. And mm-hmm. my instinct, you know, as a human before a nutritionist was, you know, go focus on your mother, be there for her. I'm not going anywhere. We'll resume our work when, you know, sort of when time allows, you know, when she's better or when your head is, you know, sort of more in it, feeling that was humane and sort of, I don't know, the gentler approach. So it turns out the next time, you know, months pass. The client made an appointment, came into my office. He was sort of a tough guy and screamed at me, which probably wasn't appropriate. But what he was saying was, he said, I, you know, sort of needed your help. I was going through a crisis. And instead of having your help, I, you know, now proceeded to eat my way through this, you know, sort of illness. And now I have all of this weight to deal with. And so it was, you know, it really illustrated for me after I calmed down and my heart stopped, you know, stopped racing, that just because we're going through a crisis, which we all are right now, doesn't mean like our wellness goes out the window. Like, it still does matter. You know, we're going to emerge from this. So I think that, you know, that always, it's always stuck with me. Then when clients turned it around on me and were like, you know, I just lost my job, or I'm super stressed out over exams, whatever it is, not to say to them like, okay, you know, like, let's check back in 2 weeks, but let's have a plan. And the plan may look, what I've been saying to clients with quarantine is, let's not try to replicate our former lives. We have different levels of stress, different schedules. We're, you know, sort of cooped up with our family, you know, all day long. So your plan might look different. But I think that it's still important and almost stress relieving to have a plan.
Yeah.
And that plan isn't just don't bake, but the plan may be, how much water are you drinking? How's your sleep? You know, what are you doing to relieve yourself of this stress? So I think that it's not just a question. I think we all feel we have, like, healthy or unhealthy as our choices. In terms of baking, I think, you know, I totally understand, like, cooking for me is what baking is for other people. And I sometimes cook way more than my family can eat. Mm-hmm. I think just, like, the best way to go with that is to try to just use healthier ingredients and somewhat healthier. Like, I like a lot of the paleo baking recipes and things of that nature.
Yeah.
I think it gives you that sense of, like, something delicious and comfort oriented, but maybe with, like, a little bit more nutrition.
I think one thing that's really interesting about what you were just saying, and it definitely made me think, is when we're going through something else in our lives, quarantine, for example, it mm-hmm. sort of feels like our nutrition can take the back burner, but really nutrition should always be a part of our lives. I know when I'm in finals, that's my big quote-unquote break. And right. I think that also just makes me feel worse, and then I am focusing on the fact that I just ate all of this unhealthy food instead of studying for my final, and how important routine can be during that time.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I think that the difference is, and that, you know, it's actually what my book was about. It was, you know, sort of about, like, all these things from, you know, from holidays to travel, to socializing with all these things that can kind of take us away from healthy, where we're tempted to be like, okay, this isn't going to be healthy. And the truth is, you, like, if I were talking to you about nutrition during finals, I wouldn't say, like, you better not have, you know, you better not have a treat. And your plan might look different, but like, let's, you know, make sure you're getting enough protein so that your brain is working well.
Yeah.
Let's make sure that your blood sugar is stable. So I think that, you know, sort of nutrition can feel a lot like a chore. Like, I don't have the, you know, mental energy to devote to that right now, when like 5 minutes of like game planning can really make it, like, as you said, feel stress relieving.
Yeah, definitely.
But I think that's the thing, is that it's not just nutrition for our weight or nutrition, you know, sort of in this exact formal meal plan, but like, how are we doing in terms of cognition, and how are we doing in terms of anxiety, and like, what can we add in? It's not always about like taking out sugar and carbs, but like, what are the, you know, foods and supplements that can, you know, really require zero effort, or very little effort.
Yeah. And I think tying it all back into anxiety is this idea that weight and body image is something that can make people really anxious. And I think mm-hmm. routine is something that can make people feel really under control, and sort of finding that routine in what you're eating is really important.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think like, what's the right routine for this circumstance?
Exactly.
You know? And that's the thing, is that it, I think people have an image that the routine's going to feel, you know, absolutely impossible. Well, that's the wrong routine. You know?
Yeah.
If the routine is waking up and drinking a glass of water suddenly, or every time you sit down to study, having, you know, sort of something to drink, whether it's a tea or water next to you, okay, that's not so hard.
Exactly. So throughout quarantine, I have found myself snacking throughout the day, because for the mm-hmm. first time in many years, I'm home all the time and by the mm-hmm. kitchen all the time. And then by dinner, I'm not even that hungry. I don't eat a lot. And by nighttime, I'm in a bad mood because I haven't really nourished my body. So right. What are good ways to keep people from snacking during quarantine?
Yeah, well, I think that was, to me, the first thing that presented itself when I resumed sessions with clients, where people were like, I, you know, it's not even like every hour. I'm just like grazing through the whole day. And I think the big shift that had to happen for people is that we still need to set a schedule, like back mm-hmm. to what you were just saying in terms of routine. So, you know, your schedule might have been dictated by your school schedule before, or for other people, like their office schedule, when they had to get there and that kind of thing. Now what? You know, now it's sort of a free-for-all. So I think that, you know, setting a schedule, like even if your breakfast is like almost at lunchtime, still having a lunch a couple of hours later.
Yeah.
And I, you know, just putting in those real meals and kind of saying like, okay, it's going to be 11 o'clock, 3 o'clock, a snack at 5 o'clock. And then I'm just giving an example, dinner, you know, at 7 something. But I also think that the clock can be helpful to space things out, so that one thing that I do with clients is kind of using like at least a 2 hour window. So, okay, it's 3 o'clock. I'm having an apple and peanut butter. This should satisfy me until 5 o'clock. Mm-hmm. So mentally I'm going to hold off until then. And I think the other thing on this is I have a ton of clients doing schoolwork and, you know, sort of their regular work in the kitchen or close to the kitchen. And I think like even in small apartments where people can't be that far from the kitchen, try like even just not facing the kitchen.
Yeah.
Or if you can, working elsewhere. It makes a tremendous amount of difference.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I always do work in the kitchen, and I say it's because being around other people helps me stay focused, because I won't start watching TV. But
absolutely.
Looking back,
yeah, no,
I think it's
like a hub of activity in the house. You know, sort of it's like a nice place to be. But I can't tell you how many clients I was like, is there another option? You know, like, is there another place that you can be? And like all of a sudden the, you know, sort of food wasn't calling them as frequently.
Definitely. So on the topic of families, we are all at home. Or many of us are at home with our families. And within this dynamic, it's really easy and almost tempting to sort of call out people that have stated that they want to eat healthy. So if I see my sister, who has recently said she wants to eat healthy, going for cake, I might want to say, hey, like, you told me to remind you if you were eating badly to stay healthy. But I know that can be really detrimental for our mental health to sort of have people we love calling us out on what we're eating. So yeah. How do you find the balance between helping our family members get healthy and overstepping in a way that's possibly detrimental to their mental health?
Right. So the one part of that that sort of might be an exception is if somebody asks for it. So whether it's siblings, like you said, or parents or kids or spouses, like I'm generally not in favor of any unsolicited diet or exercise advice. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I think, of course, like if you're working out, you can ask if anybody wants to work out with you. Or if somebody asks the pointed question, what do you think? Like, should I have waffles or eggs for breakfast? But nobody likes to be monitored. And I think that sometimes even like our questions, like, you know, how's the food plan going when somebody is eating dessert? Like, we can all see through that. So yeah. I think that, you know, there are very few examples other than if it's like purely educational. Like I have one of my teens has been, you know, working out a bunch during, I happen to be a nutritionist too, but is working out a ton and he's like protein focused. So he's constantly asking me like, how much protein is in this? Like, I can give it, you know, it's an objective answer, but I would never say, you know, maybe if you're working out, you don't want to be eating 4 pieces of chicken. Like, it's just like, where is that going? You
know? Yeah, that's not. Yeah, I see your point. That makes sense.
So I think, and again, I hear it all the time, like people are like, but I know that they don't want to be doing this, but you just telling them that isn't going to make them do it less.
Exactly. They already know what they're doing.
Yeah, we all, like, come on, like, my spoon is in the ice cream, I'm aware, like, this is not a healthy choice. But I think that, you know, sometimes, especially with, you know, parents and kids, I think that if you are going to say something, and it could just be like, you know what, like, you know, I even said this to one of my kids, like you are in a lot better mood when you are moving your body a little bit. He didn't like it at the time, but he then did take the advice. But don't give food advice at mealtime. I mean, that's just or when somebody's eating. That's just, you know, a disaster waiting to happen.
Definitely. So at least while we're on the topic of movement, at least in NYC, I'm not exactly sure what's happening around the rest of the country. Gyms are completely closed due to COVID. And I've talked to people who have said, now that I haven't been at a gym, I don't see any reason to sort of want to go back to the gym or renew my membership. But people still need to be exercising to get their endorphins. So what are some exercises people can do to remain healthy during this time?
Yeah, I think what you said, and, you know, again, I, as somebody who came from the gym industry, I think, like, people are kind of figuring it out and aren't necessarily quickly going to return to gyms when they do open, but that's an aside. I think people are like really doing well with a lot of the great online content. So yeah. I think, you know, whether it's, you know, Peloton and they do stuff, even if you don't have like a bike or a treadmill, they even do stuff for content for walks and things like that. Torched has been a big one that people are following. Melissa Wood, you know, OB Fitness. I think that there are so many classes and training sessions and mm-hmm. in many cases less expensive than going to a gym that people have actually been pleasantly surprised. It was tricky, I have to say, with clients in big cities who were like scared to leave their house, you know, initially just, you know, I'm usually a big fan of like, okay, just like get outside and like move a little bit. But people were like, I don't want to go outside. Now that's a little bit different now.
Yeah, definitely. I think that that's something that's been really interesting for me too, where when I first got home, I didn't even want to get out of bed because I was like, what's the point in going outside?
Yeah, but, no, and I have to say, just based on mood, you know, especially early on, I feel like I had like, and we're out of the city, so it wasn't that, it was really just my motivation. Like days where I had like 10 and 15,000 steps and days where I was like, did I even like, do I have 50 steps? Like, you know, I just think it's so how we feel and our like wherewithal is like so different, you know, and it can change like on a dime.
Definitely. Definitely. So I have one final question, which is sort of on the other side of everything we've been talking about, because we've had to change routines a little bit because of quarantine. Some people are gaining a little bit of weight during quarantine, but I know others are using it to get really fit or lose some weight, I think is a better way to say it. But I actually did find an article recently that some of those people are losing weight too quickly and aren't eating enough. So if any of those people are listening, could you please describe what that does to your physical and mental health?
Yeah, so I would love to read the article just because I'm so fascinated with how this is affecting us. But I think that, you know, when stress soars, and I think even if you're not aware of it, we're under this like steady stream of stress. Some people overeat, maybe compulsively, maybe binge, and some people can't eat. So I know that's not exactly your question, but, and I know that, you know, clients that are overeating are like, I wish I was one of those people. No, you don't. There's none of that. Neither extreme feels good. And it really is a sign that, you know, sort of you're, you know, you don't have your equilibrium. I do think that, you know, I have some clients who were previously, let's say, working in offices long hours, who are now like free of a commute or, you know, don't have that like get ready time.
Yeah.
And have more time for exercise or cooking where they, you know, previously did tons of takeout. So it definitely can be an opportunity depending on how we frame it and depending on how we're feeling. But yeah, super speedy weight loss, anything that's unsustainable, A, isn't likely to last, and B, you know, we tend to then at that point lose the wrong things. The other thing is just, you know, when we're hunger is real, and, you know, under fueling is just not going to leave you, you know, sort of best equipped to deal with everything that we're dealing with right now.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think another thing, I know this is off topic, but intermittent fasting, I don't know if you're acquainted with it, but it's a big thing right now, looking at like when we eat, and there's good research behind it. But I think a lot of people take that to an extreme. I'm going to eat one meal a day, or I'm only going to eat for 6 hours a day. And especially with women versus men, this isn't going to necessarily leave you feeling your best.
Definitely. I mean, I've always been someone, my parents make fun of me for it, where like, I cannot function without breakfast.
Right.
Like, yeah. Every single morning before I leave the house, I have to have my eggs, or at least some cereal.
First of all, you're having eggs, so like, that's a good start. But yeah, it's blood sugar, you know, and one of my questions when I have new clients is, do you wake up hungry? And it's really split. Some people will say, nope, I wake up with no hunger. You know, it doesn't kick in for X hours. And other people are like, I'm, you know, hungry the second I wake up. So some of these things, it's like being a night owl versus a morning person. Like you can't really change that much. You have to work with, you know, sort of what works for you.
Yeah, exactly. And I know this isn't exactly on the topic of quarantine, but something I am really curious about is, in the mornings, if we aren't hungry, but we know that a few hours later we might be, is it okay to eat even though we're not hungry, knowing that we might not get the opportunity to eat until we're hungry?
Yeah, I think, you know, in general, we want to be honoring our hunger cues, but we also have to, if somebody is, you know, going to be in 4 classes until 1 in the afternoon, yes, we're going to eat ahead of our hunger.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is also like a chicken and an egg type thing. Sometimes people aren't hungry because they aren't eating in the morning. And when you start to put in like even something like as small as like a yogurt or yogurt and fruit, they're like, oh, now I'm getting hungry sooner. So I think especially if your schedule won't permit you to like let's say wait 2 hours and eat at 9:30 instead of 7:30, if you won't have the option to eat later, I think it is a good idea to eat something, especially if you like need to be mentally sharp.
Great. Well, thank you so much for doing this with me. I think this is going to be really, really helpful to listeners, and I appreciate you giving me your time.
Well, thank you. I think, again, great questions. I can't wait to listen to other episodes, and thank you for doing this.
Well, I